To lose a child, to lose a sibling, must be unbearable. But is it so unbearable that it should be erased? That's what British writer Richard Beard's family did. His heartbreaking new memoir is The Day That Went Missing. The day was in 1978. The Beard family, including four young boys, lived in landlocked Swindon, England, but they were on vacation in seaside Cornwall, as he writes, in search of quality time that later looks bright and simple in photographs. Richard, 11, was playing in the water with his 9-year-old brother Nick when the undertow they didn't understand pulled Nick away. Richard got out. Nick's body was found later that day. His family held his funeral, then resumed their vacation, never to speak of him again. But decades later, Richard embarked on a ferocious trip back in time, grabbing the lapels of all who might have known anything about his brother Nicky, even going back several times to the beach where Nick drowned. Richard writes, for nearly 40 years I haven't said his name, but in writing I immediately slip into present tense as if he's here, he's back, maybe writing can bring him back to life. Again, the memoir is The Day That Went Missing, and Richard Beard joins us from the BBC studios in Oxford. And Richard, I said this book feels ferocious at times in trying to get at the truth of that day. It also feels a little furious at times. How would you characterize it?
Well, I think those extreme words are appropriate in the sense that I called the book The Day They Went Missing because it was completely missing. We had managed not to speak Nicky's name for nearly 40 years. And in trying to delete the pain of the day that he died, we ended up deleting him as a person. And bringing him back was a very intense experience. But also, it required a lot of tenacity just to get through all those years of denial to try and find out the facts of what had happened that day and why we had reacted as we had.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about it. The family goes down to the coast. This is a very rocky coast. It's an isolated beach. There's no lifeguards.
Yeah, so the family is there on the beach. Nicky and I went away from where everyone else was on the beach, and we found this little cove, which actually I'd seen before, and I thought the waves looked great in there. And great when you're 11 means they look bigger. They look like they're going to be more fun to play in. Mm. And we went into the water, and of course the waves there were bigger, the currents were more powerful, the tide comes in very quickly on that part of the Atlantic coast, and we were very quickly out of our depth and in trouble.
As you describe this memory, you're trying to save yourself because you're realizing that the tide is pulling your feet right off the sand beneath you, and you see your brother's already been pulled out. He winds his head back, ligaments straining in his neck, his mouth in a tight line to keep out the seawater. That's a horrendous memory.
Well, it is. And one of the things I didn't know about this memory, although we never thought about it, a lot of things about the day, the details and where it was and the date.
Your date? You didn't remember the date.
All that had gone, but yeah. This one memory remained. There was this one visceral memory which couldn't be erased, which was of Nicky in the water, this strain in his face, this terror that he was experiencing. That remained with me, partly because I was feeling it as well. And then, of course, that decision to swim in and to leave him there. And part of the inquiry was an inquiry into myself, to say, well, why did I do that? Why did I feel this absolutely urgent need to save myself? And I think it was because I knew that I too would die if I stayed there, but it's been a hard thing to come to terms with.
Of course. I mean, you call it an inquiry. You also call it an inquest. You are both the investigator and potentially the perpetrator. You know, you're very hard on yourself at times, but you ran to try to get help. Now, years later, begins this, again, ferocious inquest. You find his school records. You're trying to figure out who he is by what teachers said about him. You find the people who rowed the boat out to save him, the people who were called from the town. You grill your mother, your father at this point, who'd already had cancer when this took place and you knew was dying. The family knew was dying. He'd already died. So you grill your mother, not kindly at times.
I broached the subject with her, not having spoken to her about it for over 35 years. And by this stage, I had done a little bit of research. So I was ahead of her, and I knew that he was very good at sport, for example, because I'd found his school reports. I knew he was good at school because they had the records from the school that he was top of the class. And the first thing that my mum said to me was that he wasn't like you. He wasn't good at sport, and he wasn't good at school, and he was going to be either a banker or a murderer. And I was shocked that she should say this. He was very like me. And then I challenged my mum about this false memory. And to her credit, immediately she let much truer memories out. She was desperate to talk about Nicky, in fact, and she'd wanted to talk about him for years. And I think our relationship gets much closer because we find there is this one thing that we want to talk about.
Well, maybe she wanted to tell herself that he was those things because it might be, I don't know, make the loss, soften this horrendous loss. She wailed. Or she
well, yeah,
yeah, wailing when he was killed. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's a coping mechanism. So in her mind, Nicky had become a kind of black sheep of the family who wasn't going to amount to very much. And therefore, in a way, it was okay that he was the one who died.
Oh, amazing.
And she'd forgotten that I was in the water with him, which he must have known at the time, as a way of not having to cope with the fact that two of her children might have died at the same time. So I understand those coping mechanisms now, and I understand them. I think we all understand them better.
What was that to go to try to, you know, re-meet somebody who, you know, you're practically the same flesh for 9 years? What was that like to re-meet him?
Well, one of the catalysts for wanting to write the book was my own two sons who'd gone through the two important ages in this book, which is 9 when Nicky dies and at 11 the age I was at the time. And I remember seeing both my boys, especially the younger one. I started the book when he was 9 years old, and I was looking at him and saying, he's 9 years old, he's a fully realised human being, he's got an interior life. All that had been lost with Nicky, so I had no sense of that human being, but I could see what a vibrant human being a nine-year-old boy is, and I just thought, I've got to get some of that back. What I didn't know when I started was when the real Nicky started to come back to me, and I made this effort to remember our relationship, the truth of it was we had a competitive relationship. I'm pretty sure it would have passed. I had quite a competitive relationship with my older brother, which eventually passed, and we're now very, very close. But at that time, and the time when he died, we were competitive. We were both very sporty. We'd have running races and fights and cricket matches. And I quite resented the fact that he was 2 years younger than me and catching up, and in the rough and tumble of family life, I felt my place was being usurped. And all that came back. And I felt that I needed to reflect that honestly as well, because we didn't have an ideal or idealized sibling relationship in which we were the best of pals. Part of the problem was, I think, is that we weren't the best of pals, which made dealing with his death even more difficult in some ways, because there was a part of me which, in a childish way, before he died, would have thought, God, things would be easier if he was dead. Which is quite hard to come to terms with,
but
easier as an adult than as a child,
right? Because that's what siblings do. Look, couple things. I had a best friend at one point in my life who was putting up pictures of her as a child. When I was looking at them, I said, oh, I recognize your brother, who I know, but who's that other boy? And she said, well, that's my other brother, and we don't talk about it. So you're not alone in this. Have you heard from people?
I've had contact from a lot of people. It's amazing how many people have a similar experience, not necessarily a brother, but an experience of bereavement or of pain, of emotional trauma, which, especially from that period of time in Britain, from the 60s through until, say, the mid-80s, when I think things started to change a bit. But in that period, this experience of emotional trauma followed by the idea that an emotional response wasn't a legitimate way to deal with it, and that the stiff upper lip should be brought into effect. And the most important thing was to move on, which means acting as normal. This is what you hear a lot at that time. You say, you know, just, you should just go on as normal. Mm. And normal means before the person had died, so as if nothing has happened. And that seems to be a very common experience. And the book seems to have allowed a lot of people to express that to me, and also in their letters and in their messages. There's a sense that they now want to share their feelings, which have been hidden about this, with their family members, with the confident hope that it will make things better, that it will release that grief and really allow them to express themselves more fully.
Because as you conclude, his death, which you were looking at it as, oh, poor Nicky, who was he, who might he have been? You were mourning that his life was stalled at 9 years old in 1978, but you realize yours was too. And you want to grow up, but you don't want to leave him behind. That feels so relevant to this. But then you have a dream, and he appears to you as a child. Do you think that dream, I don't know, did that release you a little bit?
Well, there's something in my subconscious which released this image of Nicky, which I could connect to, and which had some kind of resolution, in the sense that we're both very alive and enjoying ourselves together. Mm. And there was a real sense of joy. I don't know, I think this is common with dreams, is that waking up from a dream, and what is strongest about it is the emotion that it has created. And in this sense, it was genuinely joy. And it was a kind of real, felt like a real breakthrough in terms of connecting to Nikki in a real sense, and showing to me that writing the book had been worthwhile, that that connection was now there, and that this is something that can be done generally, is that connections which seem unutterably broken can be remade.
That's Richard Beard. His book about the drowning death of his 9-year-old brother, Nick, in 1978 is The Day That Went Missing, A Family Story. It's really quite something. Richard Beard, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We'll have an excerpt at our website. And as always, if you want to share your stories as well, please do. hereandnow.org.